Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, Larry Bagnaris talks about his memoir, Call Me Larry, A Creole Man's Triumph Over Racism and Homophobia. And Cheryl Landrieu previews the fast-approaching New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University. Larry Bagnaris is a New Orleans native, part of a proud Creole family from the 7th Ward. He attended Peter Claver, St. Aug High School, and Xavier University in the finest tradition of New Orleans Catholic education. After graduating, he moved to Houston, worked for Foley's Department Store, then a large insurance company. And while in Houston, he was two-term president of the Gay Political Caucus, chairperson of Gay Pride Week, and in 1979, founder of the city's Pride Parade. In the 1990s, he returned to New Orleans and became a lobbyist for the No AIDS Task Force and served as executive director of the city's Human Rights Commission under four mayoral administrations before retiring in 2018. Today, we're talking about his new book, Call Me Larry, A Creole Man's Triumph Over Racism and Homophobia. Larry Bagnaris, welcome to The Reading Life. I'm so happy to meet you.
I'm so happy to meet you. And I just want your people on the air to know that it's pronounced Bonnaris in French.
Okay.
And so everybody in Houston knew me as Larry Bonnaris.
I did.
So when I ran for public office, people were arguing, is this the same guy that lives in Houston? I had to correct them. So I want to make sure everybody knows that when I came back, I sat down with my cousins before I ran, and they said, you're going to lose 8 to 10 percentage points.
Yeah.
So my brother kids me. He says, you change your name and you're still lost.
Which do you like better?
I love Bonnaris.
It sounds so beautiful.
But because it's not just because it's French, but because that's what I grew up with. It has a loving, endearing. But when people say, how do you spell it? And then I spell it, they say, well, that's Bagnaris.
Yes.
I said, yeah, if you want to slaughter the name, it's Bagnaris.
Okay, I won't slaughter the name. All right, now you have lived a big life. A big, exuberant life, and it's all in this book. And you trace all of your confidence and ambition back to being part of that big, loving family. So talk a little bit about growing up in the 7th Ward and what that gave to you as a New Orleanian.
The way I look back on it and see my parents in a different light. There was so much love and care from this big household. Everything that went on in the family went on at my grandmother's house, who was a French woman, mm-hmm. who married a Haitian. That was the Creole. That was on my daddy's side. On my mom's side, they were from Honduras and Guatemala.
Yeah.
So we had the Spanish speaking and the French speaking and the Creole speaking, and we had all this in one household. So when we gathered as a family, it was a celebration of all colors and all nationalities, which as a kid, I didn't know that until I moved to Houston, when I saw the Hispanic community and thought, I found my people, those are Creoles. And they're speaking a different language. They're speaking the language of my grandparents on my mom's side. Just the love and affection. But the important part of that was that we had a protected environment. Those blocks that I walked to school from St. Anne and Broad to my grandmother's house on St. Anne and Galvez, before I got to St. Peter Cables, was littered with insults. So you got the black and the white insults. You a high yellow from the black community, you a N-word. Every time I wrote the difference, the editor would ask me, do you want to use the word? I said, the word, that was the word.
That
so let me use
said.
That word, exactly.
And you all grew up to do so many different things.
Diverse.
Yeah, so tell about your siblings.
Well, it's remarkable that in a society that told you to pick yourself up by your bootstrings. We took the bootstrings and threw them on the wall and did everything because I kid with my brother that, you know, you went from the Lafitte Project where we started out to Broadway.
Right.
He wrote a play one more time. He had starred in several plays at the Gallery Circle Theater, which is a community theater here, and became good friends with Jack that ran the theater, who encouraged him that he had a lot of talent. And then my older sister was in education for some 40, 50 years in terms of teaching kids in the public school system. And the first 3 years of that, my parents wanted her to quit because they were pulling stuff on in the public school system that hurt their heart, that their daughter was exposing to all these jokes, exposed to these things. And she just said, I love this. And then my baby sister came along and she became a doctor.
Yeah.
And he is one that she tried being a private doctor. She first started out with OBGYN and then said, nah, I don't want that. And then she decided to do emergency medicine. So she works in the emergency room. She says, I want to patch him up and put him out, and I want to make sure they're taken care of.
She's got a heart for this community.
She's got a heart for people that's aching.
Yeah.
Mind you that I was in my campaign headquarters, and there was a car accident. I ran inside and said, hey, this is your thing. There's blood out there.
Oh, my God.
Take care of it. And she was just in med school at Tulane. And then the rest of my family, my cousins were lawyers and state legislators. And they, you know, they were political before I even knew they were political.
And then you came along and you were political, too.
I was political from 16. Because when my parents took me to Chicago, which is in the book, and I thought I could sit on the front of the bus, I could eat in any restaurant I wanted to, nobody was calling me the N-word. It endured me. I could go in department stores and try on clothes, which you couldn't do here.
Yeah.
And as a 13-year-old, I thought, well, if I can do that there, why can't I do it here? So I came back with a very enthusiastic desire, and that's when it translated to a place in the book where I talked about how I suffered through being gay and knowing I was gay at 4 years old.
Now, you knew from the very beginning.
I knew it because my church taught me I was going to hell.
Well, you have this incredible story about going to the New Orleans Public Library and looking homosexuality up in a book.
I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Because what I had done was I had prayed so hard. I would do 3 stations of the cross every Lent for 2 years in preparation for confirmation. And I would pray to the Lord, please take this away from me. It still gets me. On the night the Archbishop came, Archbishop Romo, and I was in my red gown with the cap. It was a big deal back then.
Oh, yeah.
And the Archbishop coming to the church and tapping me on the face, I thought, well, that'll get rid of it all. And it was still there. And I thought, okay, I got another step I have to try. I went to the library, and I thought, well, what is this? And I made sure I went in the card catalog on the first floor.
Yeah.
That library is still there, and every time I go in there, I think about what I went through. And I looked up the word homosexual, which is, at the time and still is to me, disgusting, because it doesn't describe gay people as they should be described. And it listed it as a mental illness. And I'd say, well, if I have a mental illness, then I need a psychiatrist. And so I worked for the priest at St. Aug for 50 cents an hour for 2 summers because I knew I was going to St. Aug, having seen the band at a very early age. And I thought to myself, well, if I can get the psychiatrist to do something, and all these prayers that I play, and St. Joseph is my patron saint for my confirmation name that I selected. I prayed and prayed and prayed, and nothing happened. The psychiatrist said to me, after all these prayers, and he took my $238 that I worked 2 summers to get, he said, we can help you. We have a shock treatment program.
Oh,
and for the first time in my life, St. Joseph came in and said, you can stick that up your, because you're not going to mess up my head, my brain. I still think today what could have happened to me if I would have subjected myself to that type of treatment that
and
many
what
people
did. Happened, yeah, to other people.
Yes, it happened to other people. And I got on a streetcar, was headed for the Dumaine Street bus, and it stopped in front of Maison Blanche, and there were some picketers in front of it. And in the mind of a child, I thought, well, let's get rid of this black thing, and then there'll be a movement for gay people, I'm sure, just in my mind. So I tapped a picketer on the shoulder, and I said, I'll take one of those picket signs. Then I started marching toward the river, and a white woman passed and called me poor white trash. And then I turned around and go the other way. She spit on me first. Oh. And then she called me poor white trash. And then I turned around and went the other way. And a black woman said, you're not doing anything but causing trouble. You'd be able to be home helping your mama. And I thought, in my mind, I thought, they're not even correctly identifying me.
Right.
I didn't see it as an insult. I saw it as stupidity.
Yeah.
And so I began the civil rights movement then and mm-hmm. participated in a lot of demonstrations and stuff because of that.
Now, one of the things that did help you was finding this incredible role model at Xavier University. So tell us about that professor who made such a difference in your
Jim
life.
Jim Schaefer was a mentor that mm-hmm. As I went through the book and was putting it together, I didn't realize how close we were. We did several trips together.
Uh-huh.
And the first trip was, I came out to him in a swimming pool with my fraternity across the lake. And it was called the Creole Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with all my fraternity brothers. And they had gone off to, and it was just him and I. And I started crying. And he said, what's wrong? I said, I'm gay and I don't want to be. And he said, well, tell me about it. I felt comfortable enough to tell him that. And he said, well, I said, New Orleans is just, it's not my kind of, this is not gay. He said, no, this is bars and people getting drunk and people mm-hmm. having a good time. That's what not gay is. But when you finish college, when you finish your last year, let's go to New York. I'll show you what gay life is really like, the diversity of it.
Uh-huh.
So we wind up in New York City, and we went to one of the first places to challenge the gay community in terms of two men having drink together. You have to have a woman with you in order mm-hmm. to have a drink. Julius's. His friends, we were having hamburgers and stuff. His friend said, this kid, because I was much younger, he uh-huh. said, this kid ought to be around the corner at the Stonewall. I didn't know what the Stonewall was.
You were there one night when it was raided.
That's correct. So I go to the Stonewall, and I run into this kid from Brooklyn. And trust me, it was like dining going to heaven, because the tribal beat of the music and seeing the diversity of people and people dancing. I was dancing with a guy for the first time. And then all the lights went on. And he grabbed me by my hand. And he said, let's go. He said, it's a raid. And I had heard of raids in New Orleans, mm-hmm. but I had never been in one. And so he's taking me by the hand into the bathroom to climb out the window.
Oh, my God.
And I started crying. And he said, what's wrong with you? I said, this is like West Side Story. I just saw West Side Story. He said, if you
your
don't move your ass.
In the Stonewall Inn, and you're like, this is like a good news, bad news joke.
Yes, yes,
you know, this is like my place. These are my people.
Yes. And he said, if you don't move your ass, you're going to be arrested. It was at that moment it dawned on me, climbing out of that window, that if I had been arrested, nobody in New Orleans knew I was gay. None of my teachers knew I was gay. None of the people I hung out with knew I was gay. My life would have been completely ruined, because not only your name went in the paper, that's the reason why I avoided raids in New Orleans mm-hmm. and was very conscious of my environment. I thought, I've got to find the gay civil rights movement. There's got to be something. So after that first raid at the Stonewall, that wasn't a big raid. That was the month before the one that got all the publicity. And I went home to tell my friends and stuff. I kept going back to New York City to have meetings at the firehouse and seeing how this thing was developed and seeing the people involved and getting the language correct and participating in it. So when it finally arrived in Houston in 1978, I had a job to protect with the investment corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't looking at coming out and doing all that, but Anita Bryan did that for me.
And she did. And that's how you told your parents.
Yes. I came here. Anita Bryan came to Houston. That's how I told the Houston community. Of course, when you're a young man and you think you said your name on a television at a gay pride march, you think, oh my God, I've just announced it to the world,
yeah.
Which is not true. But back then I thought, oh my God, what have I done? And so after protesting Anita Bryan in Houston, my two best friends of some 50 something years now, and I drove back to New Orleans to participate in the Anita Bryan march because I knew I had to come out to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting around the kitchen table, and I said, S. Raymond and David, give me a moment with my parents. My parents loved them because they were one of the first two people I brought around, and they just had the manners, and because they were brought up in the same like family and culture that I was. My parents were sitting around the kitchen table, and I came out and said, I'm here to protest against Anita Bryan. And my dad said to both of us, it's your fault. I said, you say this,
right,
mama's
to your mother.
And I said, well, if it is, then she gets all the credit. He said, I read that in a book. I said, go get the book. So he went get the book. The copyright on the book was like, that's the first play. I said, this thing was copywritten in the 40s.
Yeah.
I was about to tell him about the psychiatrist. I said, nah, I'm going to just let all that go. I'll just share with them, I'm the happiest person in the world. And if that's the case, mama, give me a hug because you deserve all the credit. And
good
daddy, you
her.
Don't get any. And we went off to the march.
So now that you're finished and you look back at your life, this is like a real rite of passage when you write a memoir. How does your life look to you? Does it look different than you thought? Is it bigger than you thought?
Oh, God, totally. I had no idea that you could take and celebrate being who you are, color-wise, sexuality-wise, and age-wise. I would always run from my age. Well, I was 78 years old. I celebrate the fact that I've made it this far.
Yeah.
And the benefits of having good family and good friends and making sure that I try and translate that and give that to everybody I can reach out to. So the book's intention is to do those things and make sure that the world knows that every human being has a right to exist totally and free of intimidation. And so why I wrote the book was the same as I told you earlier, the three reasons that the celebration of being a gay man is in this environment, having challenged and overcome those challenges.
It's such a joyful book. It really is. And it's
Thank
a tale, you.
You
know, it's a history of gay culture, gay life in Houston and New Orleans. It's an important document. You've done so much for so many people.
Well, I was one of the last few people of color. When you read the book, that was in the beginning of the first March on Washington, the second March on Washington.
Yep.
All the marches on Washington involved, particularly the politics in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I feel like I've been blessed and I had a responsibility to share that with the world.
Make a difference.
Yes.
We've been talking with Larry Bonnaris Bagnaris, whose new book is Call Me Larry, A Creole Man's Triumph Over Racism and Homophobia. You can meet him at the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival coming up March 28th through 30th, when he'll be inducted into the Saints and Sinners Hall of Fame. Larry, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's March, and that means it's festival time for readers and book lovers of all ages. It's a great pleasure to welcome Cheryl Landrieu, co-chair with Walter Isaacson of the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University, to talk about the impressive offerings at the fourth festival. This free event takes place March 27th through 29th at Tulane's Uptown campus. Now, Cheryl, welcome. It's so good to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back talking about the New Orleans Book Festival.
And it's bigger and better than ever this year.
Yes, we're trying. We try to grow something new every year, so we're excited to have another new offering this spring.
Well, let's look at some of the highlights. I mean, the kickoff event is really remarkable Thursday night, so talk a little bit about that.
So again, as last year, we are partnering with The Atlantic in our opening session, and they're going to have a conversation that's going to be led by the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, and there'll be two parts to that session. That begins at 5 o'clock on Thursday, March 27th. The first part will be a discussion with Jeffrey and Ann Applebaum, and it'll be on foreign policy and things that she writes about. And then the second part of that will be with writers and authors McKay Coppins, Elena Plot Calabro, and Adam Serwer. Those three will talk about the things that they've been writing as well. And then the second part of that opening session is with author and founder of the Equal Justice Institute, Brian Stevenson. So that'll be the opening night, Thursday, March 27th from 5 to 7.
Now, one of the things we do so well in Louisiana is transplant festival culture of all types onto literature. So you have a full listing of food events that people will enjoy and chefs who are coming.
We do. And so each year we have had some type of cooking discussion with cookbooks. This year we've expanded it to four different sessions. And so it's going to be a big array of things for people that are interested in cooking and culture. One of them is with Alexander Smalls, who's an African chef in New York, who's coming down to speak to some African chefs here. And he wrote a beautiful, beautiful cookbook that helped him feature there. And then we have a panel on sandwiches, because it's based on an article that was done as New Orleans Sandwich Capital. We have something on New Orleans best chefs, and so we'll have a conversation with them on their cooking and their writing. And then we have Nina Compton and Nini Nguyen in a conversation together on their book. So both of them are from former Top Chef entrants. So that'll be a good conversation as well. So there'll be a lot of cooking and food.
Now talk all about Family Day, because that's one of the distinguishing features of the New Orleans Book Festival. And it began as a children's book festival. So you've grown out from that.
It did. And I'm so proud that we've been able to keep the Family Day portion of the festival in this larger event. You know, we started in 2010 with the Children's Book Festival, and it's grown over the years, and that now it's a big part of our offerings on Saturday, March 29th, and it's designed to be a free event for the school children and their families in New Orleans to come together across neighborhoods and get to know each other and to listen to author readings and to engage in literacy activities, get free books from Scholastic. Each child will go home with three free books that they can choose themselves. We have free food and music, of course, and it's just that's a very fun day from 10 to 2 on Saturday, March 29th. So I encourage families to really consider taking advantage of this offering.
Now, what's your measure of success for the festival? What is it that lets you know you've done a great job?
It's hard to know for me exactly what the measure of success is. The way I personally judge it is the synergy and the energy and the excitement that people bring to the festival themselves and their ability to connect with everybody. We do the basic measures in terms of how many people come and the number of sessions we produce and things like that. So I think those have grown every year, so we can be proud of our accomplishments and the fact that we're able to keep this free and open to the public, which is, you know, a strong mission of ours, thanks to the generous support of all of our sponsors. So I think there are a lot of ways to measure success, but the way I like to do it is to hear from the participants and the attendees after the festival. We do a survey and we get great feedback.
Well, there's nothing like seeing all those young readers walking around with free books. We've been talking with Cheryl Landrieu, who's co-chair of the 4th Annual New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University. You can check out bookfest.tulane.edu for specific information. Thanks so much, Cheryl.
Thank you, Susan. Good talking to you.
You too. Take care. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Julie Vokerson signs Creole Made Easy with the Creole Sausage Queen, Saturday, March 22nd from 1 to 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Three Muses presents a reading with Stacey Balkin and Sky Jackson, Saturday, March 22nd from 2 to 4 at 536 Frenchman Street. Benjamin Morris will host a poetry reading featuring Dylan Krieger, Emily M. Goldsmith, Jeff Munsterman, Wanda Noonan, Gina Ferrara, Stephanie Russell, Jack Bedell, and Madeline Trosclair Rotolo, Saturday, March 22nd at 2 at the Old Metairie Library on Metairie Road. Kristen Arnett appears in conversation with Isaac Fitzgerald to launch her new book, Stop Me If You've Heard This One, Saturday, March 22nd at 4 in the backyard at BJ's. That's 4301 Burgundy Street. Jamie Attenberg hosts, but this is a ticketed event presented by Blue Cypress Books. Nick Stone appears in conversation with Jumata Emil to discuss her new book, Dear Manny, Saturday, March 22nd at 5 at Baldwin & Company, part of the day-long Inspire NOLA Literacy Festival. Jennifer Ledet discusses and signs Live and Lead by Choice, Not by Chance, Sunday, March 23rd at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Catherine Cowart-Rowe discusses and signs No More 24/7, Entrepreneurs Take Your Life Back, Monday, March 24th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. One Book, One New Orleans rescheduled its workshop, Create Your Family Timeline, an interactive community workshop with Fatima Sheikh, to Tuesday, March 25th from 5 to 6:30 at Rosa Keller Library and Community Center. If you've already RSVP'd, you don't need to re-register, but there are still spots available. Check out One Book, One New Orleans Facebook page. The literary world shifts into high gear as three literary festivals get underway later this week. The 39th Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival kicks off Sunday, March 23rd, with the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest, then runs Wednesday through Sunday, March 25th through 30th. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete schedule. The 4th New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University starts Thursday, March 27th, and runs through Saturday, March 29th. Check out bookfest.tulane.edu for complete listings. And the 22nd Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival takes place March 28th through 30th. Check out sasfest.org for complete listings. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.